I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Isaac Chapa. I'm the VP of Systems and Operations for a company called CSID. We do voice biometrics and identity theft protection. My partner here.
I'm Dan Miller. I'm the senior analyst and actually the founder of a company called Opus Research. And we cover something called conversational commerce and also mobile commerce. And in the process of covering that over the past 25 years or so, we began thinking about voice biometrics and the use of voice to be a unique identifier for people in order to promote more efficient electronic commerce. And that's why we're here today.
Exactly. So one of the things we want to do, we really don't want to go off the slides, but we like to ask you if you can be interactive with us. I know it's a little bit late in the afternoon, but at any point, if you have any questions, feel free to stop us or ask any additional questions. But for now, we'll start off with a couple of slides on here.
So I will take it from here about, here's why we're here. We're here to talk about voice biometrics. That includes just sort of some of the basic definitions of terms and talk about some of the ideas and share, that's the key word here, some of the ideas of why we look to different factors to support stronger authentication of individuals on communications networks. Get feedback from this group here. We're assuming that we have users, developers, implementers who are in the room to try to learn more about the technology and where it may fit or present business opportunities for them. And to that end, describe some of the real-world implementations and use cases that we're seeing. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised to hear just how widespread use is at this point in time.
One of the things people always ask is, what exactly is a voice print? Essentially, there's two main categories of a voice print. There's the physical aspect of your voice print. That's going to be your larynx, your trachea, things that are functionally a physical trait of your body itself. And the second thing is your behavioral. It's much more of your pitch, your tone, and maybe your accent. So the combination of those two is what we create a voice print. And that's essentially what we store as an algorithm in our databases.
And I think what's important to note there is that in any scheme that uses voice prints or voice biometrics, if it's well designed, it isn't storing a recording of what you say. And for those of you that might be familiar with or who have enrolled in voice biometric systems or know people who have, In some ways, during that enrollment process, you're either asked to record a phrase or a series of numbers repeatedly. And some of the early feedback that was obtained by the early technology providers and implementers is that individuals kind of felt that maybe the technology wasn't working at this point. You know, why do I have to train this? Why are they having so much trouble recording it? And there's two pieces of good news surrounding that. One is that based on experience, implementers have learned how to train contact center agents or others to manage the expectations of individuals when they go to enroll, so that they understand that we're going to ask you to repeat the same thing three times so that we get a sufficient voice sample. So that's good news number one. Good news number two has to do with advancements in the technology itself, so that thanks to work in the lab, thanks to improvements in the algorithms and that sort of thing, you just don't need as much basic voice material to make voice prints. And that has allowed for more flexibility in terms of what it takes to enroll. That may explain why we're seeing that there are as many, that there's been an upswing in implementations of enrollments around the world. You know, by our count, at year-end 2011, there were over 10 million individuals had enrolled their voice prints in various categories, and that's enterprise employees to support such things as password reset, just part of the onboarding by HR. They're collecting voice prints to support later log on to secure environments. The two single largest implementations are well over 3 million individuals, and it's by one is by Bell Canada, the phone company in and triple play or quadruple play provider in Canada. The other is the second largest mobile carrier in Turkey. It's a company called Turkcell, and they, in the space of like a year and a half, have enrolled over 2.5 million individuals. So,
and essentially a third. I mean, we can actually talk ourselves. Our company has deployed in the online education space. So one of the things that you might see is when you go to online schools, it's a big thing these days. We've actually done some biometrics in the actual online education space. So it's definitely something that's applicable in different areas. So it's something that can be easily integrated with additional sources.
Yeah. You can't hear us?
No.
I think that
we'll talk a little bit louder, too.
That goes for me, too. So that, I guess I jumped the shark on the slide. I was sort of asking, you know, why now? And what one of the major things, you know, in addition to the distance learning and that sort of thing, what we expect there to be an exponential growth in enrollments related to mobile commerce and relating to support of mobile transactions. And the reason it becomes geometric is that there are multiple use cases around the use of your mobile phone to support transactions. And that's organic growth. There's a company called Juniper Research that's more into the mobile transaction world than Opus is showing that they're expecting $670 billion spent through mobile wallet-like services in 2015, up from $240 billion in 2011, and that this is a global phenomenon. A lot of the activity is in, I mean, we always think of these as being sort of high-tech applications that depend on smartphones and that sort of thing. But a lot of electronic transactions arise from in emerging economies with migrant employees using their phones to transfer funds back to where they live. So we're seeing East Asia, the Middle East, China having a large population of users. Western Europe was sort of early adopters. When I typed this slide, I was wondering if I still wanted to include them given all the economic crisis there. And North America is something of a laggard at this point, but that's going to be the succession that adoption takes place.
One of the problems with mobile devices themselves is they're actually not very secure. I mean, some of you guys have seen some of the hacking with different types of phones out there. So one of the things we bring to the voice technology itself is the ability to secure your application or your device at a much stronger level. So that's one of the ways to actually get out there and deploy it. You know, we want to make sure that even though you have this on here, you have your phone and it has a password, it can be easily hacked or compromised. I saw an article the other day with Google Wallet where you could just reset to your factory settings and it would actually take off the actual password to your Google Wallet. So it's pretty easy to compromise some of your devices. So inherently we can add voice to these mobile devices or any other technologies to try to make them much secure.
And another thing to think about, and Isaac was hinting at this, is that seldom do you use voice as the only factor in terms of securing any device. And as a matter of fact, the implementers have the benefit of guidance from the bank auditors or the government entities that are in charge of sort of making suggestions in how banks should comply with common sense guidelines. Mm-hmm. And the three watchwords in this case is that they're layered, which some people call context sensitive, that there be perhaps a easy hurdle to go over if all you're trying to do is retrieve some information, check a balance or something like that, and that as you progressively move up to more risky situations, you might add another factor. So one thing may just be password protected, but as you progress through, you know, and I like the distance learning example. There's you know, it's very important, I think, that the educational institution confirm that the individual that started the test is indeed the person that finished it. And it turns out that a biometric, something that has to do with what you are, is a much more important factor at that point than somebody who I just shared my password with, or and then let take the test for me, or something like that. So those are the cases where we're seeing, a layered approach, well, both layered and multi-factor. And the third is that they be device oriented, and that could be a little harder to explain. The a lot of electronic banking is desktop-based, and we've gotten questions over the years about why do I care about voice authentication if I'm not using a phone, if I'm using a desktop? And if you think of CS Identity's application with distance learning, that is a screen-based desktop application, and you might want to describe how voice sort of fits into that. And that's an example of, addressing sort of the constraints of the device and using out-of-band authentication.
Yeah, another example is, I won't mention any names, but we've done a demo back a couple years ago with certain banks in which they were doing wire transfers using your phone. Well, these wire transfers were $50,000, $100,000 business transactions, and their verification tool was calling your number and basically saying, is it you? It wasn't asking any kind of verification. They would just call your phone number and say, can you authorize this transaction? Well, if the phone's stolen, you just answer the phone and you verified that tool. So, here's a real-world application where people are just doing wire transfers by just validating your phone number. You know, another layer would be any kind of voice verification to say, yes, it is me. My password is 58321 or whatever the number will be. So that's something that can help strengthen some of this using the multi-factor authentication.
And actually, if you go right, so where, the bullet that says complex device identification is considered more secure by the bank auditors, I don't know, how many have, you use online banking, use the phone-based banking? So you're pretty familiar with this. The most common sort of multi-factor complex approach these days has been, if you're online and you try to set up a transfer of over a certain threshold, chances are they've asked you to enroll your mobile device as the authentication, almost as a hard token, and they will send a one-time password, a password that expires, so that when you receive it, you can put it in, and because it's complex, they're kind of convinced that it provides the confidence that the person that has your phone and is at your computer and got that code is you. But when you think about it, there is no strong assurance that beside a biometrics that can offer that strong confidence without a doubt.
So essentially, this is what we've been talking here is, it's treating your phone itself as the solution, using the one-time passwords with KBA or any kind of biometric itself. One of the things with biometrics, additional biometrics outside of voice, there's retinal scanning, there's fingerprint scanning. One of the challenges with those types of solutions is your phone itself is not a device that can easily capture that. It may be able to capture an image, like a snapshot, but it's not actually the device that's proven to actually scan your fingerprint. So the cost to deploy voice is essentially any kind of phone device, which nearly everybody has, whereas with fingerprints or retinal scanning, you likely need to purchase additional hardware to actually implement the solution. So, that cost of deployment can be significant when you're trying to compare solutions.
And also while on that topic, there's two kinds of failure that can, overall there's two kinds of failure that can happen that can restrict successful use of a biometric technology. One is failure to enroll, which is, capturing a fingerprint, capturing an iris scan, taking a picture and associating it with distinctive features of yourself. And the other is failure to authenticate. And that is what it sounds like, that it's statistical. You capture the characteristics when you're trying to authenticate. You send it to a biometric engine, if you will, and it returns a score that reflects the confidence that the sample that was just taken is a match with what was taken when you enroll. What can happen with fingerprint devices is they can get smeared. sort of the same thing as we start thinking about using the camera on a phone or on a laptop, that there is the opportunity for there to be either distortions or things out of focus and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the other things that people always, the very first question people ask with voice is, what if I'm sick? You know, can I pass if I'm sick? Well, technically, when you're sick, you're probably not going to be doing any kind of voice transactions. You're not going to be working with your bank, things like that. So, yes, it could fail. But that's one of the things that we talked about with on par with alternatives. There is an error rate with voice. You know, it can be adjusted in our solution where it's a SaaS solution. You can do a 99.9% pass rate or 90% pass rate, depending on what you feel is secure. But they are just like every other device. There are going to be error rates with it. But the thing is it's pretty much on par with other solutions. Registration with voice is relatively easy. Again, it's just about less than a 60-second transaction on a phone or a PC mic or whatever that can capture your voice. You really don't need the equipment, as we mentioned earlier. And then you can actually integrate it with other solutions or other systems. So one of the things we'll talk about as well is potentially in your IT system. So on your desktop, when you're doing a password reset, you could actually integrate it with your desktop machine to allow you in just like the fingerprint scanners that are on these devices.
And what's been going on these days is that, you know, getting back to that spirit of having a layered approach that is context sensitive and risk sensitive, is that we are layering on multiple factors. And there's receptivity and understanding of this among the general public. You know, if Microsoft can sell Kinect on the idea that now your video game, you know, understands how you move, the idea that there's enough intelligence either in the device itself or somewhere in the cloud to understand that you are unique, the way you move is unique, different attributes of yourself is unique, you can essentially have a running tally going on about how much confidence you have that the individual who has a particular device is the individual that's supposed to have that. And you can use that even to adjust the level of risk you attach to the next thing that person does, so that you know when to layer on another authentication factor before you let them take on. You know, we talked about the simplistic thing of, you know, geez, if after 20 years of having my bank account with Bank of America, somebody all of a sudden wants to transfer all of my checking and savings over to an account in China, it knows to red flag something like that. But the notion that you know, somebody may have been standing behind me at an ATM and writes down my PIN and shows up and takes out that daily limit, you know, maybe every third day or something like that, you don't necessarily organically and quite responsibly add those extra factors that you're going to ask for. So what we're seeing is solutions, authentication solutions that include voice is probably the best way to frame this, and that we're adding sort of awareness of risk levels, and that we're adding ways that voice leverages or augments the existing security and encryption factors that are in play at a bank, at an educational institution, with a government agency, and that sort of thing.
So one of the things, we've talked about a couple of samples already. Customer care is definitely one of the big ones. You know, one of the big costs in a call center is essentially your verification. So when you call in and, let's say you're calling your cable company, the first thing they're going to ask you is, what's your name? What's the last four of your social? Just to verify that it's truly you doing the transaction. Well, one of the cost savings is if you can put voice verification in front of that in the IVR itself, that's about a minute worth of a call that you can reduce in your call center. And if you have, 1,000, 2,000 calls a day, that can be significant. So there's definitely cost savings in that aspect of it. We've talked about some of the mobile payment, maybe even waking up your device. Interesting one, maybe VPN. We've talked about that a bit. Essentially, it's another multi-factor. I mean, some of you guys may use RSA keys for your devices. You could use another factor of voice verification as a way to authenticate and VPN into your network as another multi-factor authentication. Various scenarios with password resets. I mean, we've talked about a few here, but, it can be anything from your email to your bank to secure transactions, allowing you to authenticate through them.
And each one of these has a little engine behind it that is driving stepped-up adoption. And I'd just like to tease out a few of these. The password reset is evolving into something more like password replacement. And IBM Research this year named voice biometric authentication as one of the five technologies to be watching to have mass adoption in the next 5 years. And one of the things that's driving it is all of the rules now surrounding password management in enterprise organizations. I don't know how many of you work in large companies. This is more of an entrepreneurial sort of setting, but these days, you talked about these days to log onto a VPN with some of the larger companies in the world, you have to change your password every 3 months. It used to be a password was 4 digits. Now it's minimum of 8. It used to be that they were either letters or numbers. Now you have to use at least one special character and a number and a cap and a small. And there's no way a human being can remember a password. Well, you can't forget your voice. And that's why in some ways we're looking at using a voice biometric at least as part of a way to keep security, but add a level of convenience and humanity to the secure network access. It is a form of personalization, looking at this top bullet. And I think this is a very, very important thing to think about from a marketing and packaging point of view of any solution that includes voice biometrics, is that the reason we're trying to promote strong authentication of the individual has to do with how much interaction and commerce and social networking relies on a strong belief that the person you're communicating with is indeed the person that he or she claims to be. And without that level of trust, you stop feeling confident in carrying out the things that you would every day. And I think that takes a little while to gnaw at you, but for the most part, people operate with an okay level of trust, but as it gets more crucial to our own personal digital lives, strong authentication gets important as well.
Mm-hmm. So we mentioned the call centers. There are over 8 million voice prints registered on this as well, just not in our company, unfortunately, but globally. So it is definitely, as we talked about, some of that with the remote workers as well, VPN and password reset.
And so one of the drivers in the contact center, which I think is very important to note too, is that it's sold on the notion of convenience and time savings. And where there are high volumes of transactions, every second that you can shorten that it takes to authenticate a person and get them doing what they are calling about is true savings for the company, but it's a convenience feature for the individuals that are trying to accomplish what they're doing. And if the alternative to to just sort of saying your passphrase turns out to be answering three or four knowledge-based answers till the company is convinced that you are who you are, that gets rid of some of the anxiety or anger that people can feel when they when they're using their phone to try to get things done.
So we've talked about a couple of these. I mean, one of the things with fixed and mobile phones is just the flexibility of that. So there's definitely some global capabilities with that. When you think around all the phone adoption around the world, phones are readily available. We talked a little bit about it as well online, essentially having secure access from your browser, whether it be through your banking session or online education. You can prompt a user itself online and maybe have them via Skype or through a PC microphone actually conduct the transaction through the web browser. You can actually do, you know, desktop hardware devices or even a custom solution on-premise. And, of course, call centers. We've talked about that quite a bit here. Some of the deployment opportunities, we provide a SaaS-hosted solution. So essentially, we are hosting the application, the IVR transactions. You can integrate via custom XML or voice XML APIs. You can actually do an on-premise appliance, which means essentially you can get a hardened device and actually deploy it on your own production environment. Similarly, you can actually get a device and install it on your actual phone. That way you're not actually conducting the transactions over the internet or outside of your network. So there's numerous ways to deploy the technologies themselves that are that been proven and effective. So do we have any questions from anyone? If you can come up to the mic. Maybe they can hear you better than you guys can hear us.
It's a little better when I get closer. So my question is, with the way that you can digitize everything and you can get perfect quality, it's not like you can, you know, what do you do about fraud? So it's not beyond the pale to think that someone can record your voice and they get, you know, do some program to get the right words so that way they could steal your money out of your bank account if they could authenticate you. Like, how do you prevent the fraud piece when it comes to voice?
Definitely, that's a good question. That's one of the common things with the technologies is essentially how can you prevent it from being recorded. One of the things we have in our technology, and I'm assuming this is something that a lot of people do in the industry, we include what we call a liveliness detection. The liveliness basically determines, is it a live person or does it seem like it's possibly recorded? One of the things we do is we actually change the numeric value. That's it's a random number that people are stated, so we do not ask the same number sequence every time. And that helps conduct the liveliness. So if the score itself says this person is 100% match, well, that's probably not going to happen. You know, I would say 1, 1, 1. You guys might have heard that all the same, but the actual algorithms see that as three different ones. When every time I say one, it's a little bit different based on the wavelength. So the technologies are proven to determine, based on that wavelength, is there a difference between the first one and the second one, essentially.
And if the question was along the lines of if you're moving these voice prints into the cloud where all we hear about is, oh, anybody can hack that and copy it, they're just big digital files. The voice prints themselves are distillations of the characteristics of the voice. It's not like we take a recording and there's Dan's voice associated with Dan in a flat file that has all of Dan's other attributes. There's just these files that are not associated with anything until the application says, oh, compare this file to that, and returns a score. So that if somebody hacks in and says, look, I got everybody's voice print here, they really haven't done that much harm to the solution. If that makes sense.
Yes, sir. I have a few questions, if people will indulge me. The first is, the telephone system itself, even though like the microphone on the cell phone might be extremely accurate, the underlying infrastructure, like certain tones get dropped or emphasized. So how does that play into your system? Does that always like decrease the accuracy that you're going to get because it was either recorded or you're verifying over that?
Yeah. There's quite a few answers to that. There's a few solution providers that make addressing the level of risk based on different line characteristics, different characteristics of an individual's voice, because oddly enough, some, like a tenor, or some people say even a woman's voice is more prone, even if you're doing speech recognition or something like that, to lead to some failure to recognize. There's a couple of solutions providers that even in enrollment do a first, you know, assess what type of line they're on, assess how exposed that particular type of voice is to fraud, and we'll ask for a more lengthy enrollment process to get more material so that they can address the level of risk that's inherent in a particular type of voice over a particular line. Now, when you think about that in sort of real-time authentication, there are different algorithms for wireless, for IP telephony, for old landlines, just recognizing the characteristic of the line and what's to be expected in terms of how the captured utterances should be compared to the voice print given all those dependencies. Mm-hmm. So over time, solutions providers have learned how to address those exposures. And it's not perfect. And one of the reasons multi-layered multi-factor became the mantra and not make voice biometrics better is a recognition that no single factor is ever going to be strong enough to do much more than return some score that tells you how you want to treat it given what you know about.
Sure.
I think if you could improve line quality, that would be another million-dollar idea. You know, if poor data quality providers out there, if you could fix your voice, that's a great solution.
Another technical question. Right now there's the perception that a telephone call is more secure than like an email, that people are more willing to pick up a phone and read credit card numbers and send them over an email or even over the web. In the markets where they have like 3 million subscribers, 30 million, has that perception changed? Is there more like hacking, more phone taps? Are people being more conscious of that? Have you seen that perception go down?
No, I mean, I think people, you know, it's one of those things, voice itself is pretty secure these days. I mean, VoIP and things of that nature are encrypted when it's actually submitted over the lines. You know, if people are cautious or worried about their line being tapped, I would think there's maybe a different situation going on with that person that they have to worry about. So, you know, if there is that perception out there, unfortunately, that it's going to exist. But, you know, people like Dan, who really go across the world talking about voice biometrics, are really here to try to dispel some of that because it doesn't happen. I mean, it's not like everything's being recorded unless you're in certain countries.
Okay. And the last question is more about psychology. There's one use of this, which is obviously securing and authentication, but there's the other convenience factor. And what have you seen, if anything, as far as invisible authentication? An analogy would be like a thumbprint scanner like on the doorknob, so you can just like walk up to your house and open the door, and mm-hmm. they don't even realize that's there most of the time. Or like in the IVR, recognizing their voice just as part of the process of going through the prompts.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I come from the telecom world again, and you know, with the IVR itself, it's one of those great things about voice recognition. It really can see what's going on. Unfortunately, a lot of these companies don't use it. You know, if you notice when you call your cable company, they're going to ask you for your account number. Mm. Well, they have your account number, but what's the first thing they do when they actually talk to you? Can you give me your account number? You know, so the actual technology is there to implement it, so the ease of use is available. It's just for some reason a lot of these technologies just not deployed. You know, for whatever reason, cost on their side, maybe they're scared or, you know, some of the misconceptions. But there's a lot of technologies that are proven that can actually work and give you that data. It's just a matter of how you use it.
More question?
Curious about the typical user experience based on the way the technology works. You described an enrollment process and then an actual authentication process. Mm-hmm. Is it that you're having a user say a specific thing, and then they're expected to repeat that specific thing in your matching? Or are you abstracting somehow and then ask them to repeat something different? Like, what is a typical way that it's implemented?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's numerous ways to deploy, so we'll give you a couple samples. Number one is kind of our common methodology. When you verify, we actually do two-factor authentication on our front end. Being an identity theft company, we have access to public records, credit reports, et cetera. So we'll actually authenticate your identity first, you know, is based on your credit report, what credit cards you own, et cetera. We want to make sure it's you before we capture your voice. Once we know that it's you or feel that we've identified that it's you, we're going to capture your voice through a sequence of utterances or random numbers. That can be tuned. We normally we'll do something like six different random sequence of numbers, so 3, 4, 8, 2, 1, and we repeat, you know, those different sequence of numbers about six times. You can adjust the threshold. You can do twice, but that's going to lower your scoring algorithm or the information you have to score that voice print. You can do more, but then it's going to be a longer call, and the person's going to be annoyed that they keep on repeating it. So we kind of feel like six has been our good and happy medium of how many times to capture that voice. Once you go through that, that will call itself is usually a couple minutes. That will store the original voice print on file for your identity. So now we've captured that algorithm in our database associated with your identity. Thereafter, anytime we want to verify you, we'll go ahead and do one sequence of numbers and score it immediately. So the verification piece is less than 60 seconds. You know, we'll just do that same sequence of random numbers, let them do that, and then actually store that score and pass or fail. Maybe even allow them to reattempt if they want to or choose to do that.
And to zoom out a little bit, what Isaac's describing is something called text-dependent authentication, which assumes that there is a passphrase or a series of numbers that that the system is that are enrolled when during that enrollment process and then invoked in the authentication process. There's a separate strain called text-independent, and which is actually language-independent, which is playing off both the physical and behavioral characteristics of a voice regardless of what the person says. Now, when you start thinking about that, there's some trends going on both in research laboratories and in a few commercial implementations for passive enrollment where you can collect any utterances. You can do it from recordings. People don't have to go through a formal enrollment process, and then text-independent authentication of a caller so that in the course of their normal interactions, there could be sort of an ongoing indicator of the confidence that that individual is whom they claim to be at the beginning and that they didn't change at any point during the conversation. And then, you know, there's stuff going on in the lab around, and this is globally, around how little information do you need in order to enroll, and how short a transaction do you have before you can consider a person to be strongly authenticated. And, you know, in the lab, they're basically saying, you know, you could do it with 6 seconds. You can authenticate with 6 seconds after having collected 20 seconds or whatever it is. And the numbers keep getting shorter. But to whoever the last person's, your point about the different characteristics of the risk that's introduced by using different lines, different, you know, types of microphones and that sort of thing. You cannot assure as you move out into the real world that you're going to be able to rely on short utterances to authenticate and that sort of thing. So it's subjective and but it's progressing, and we have experience mostly in the lab, but you will see more deployments in the wild of text-independent implementations and perhaps passive stuff. There's a creep factor involved with passive enrollment and disclosure. There's a lot of things that have not been ironed out when you actually go to deploy, because it does seem Big Brother-ish and on down the list.
Mm-hmm. Question, if we step back from technology for a second, just talk about practicality. The ubiquitous CAPTCHA on all our e-commerce sites, and not authenticating me, but authenticating that I'm a human. if I think about trying to enroll my voice on all these different places where I have passwords now, it just forget about it. I'm not going to do this 50 times across every different retailer. So you guys have any thoughts just about the practicality of rolling this out? This isn't, at this point, some clearinghouse where it's available to every website. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is... It's a fascinating area because there's real parallels to the federation of identity and all sorts of things across transaction networks. And it seems like when you do get into credit card networks or even something as simple as single sign-on and vouching for individuals moving from website to website, It has all those problems inherent. Now, it would make a lot of sense for there to be, and there are some initiatives around establishing voice trust centers, which are cloud-based repositories for enrolled voice prints with some sort of authority that associates them, ideally, anonymously, with a claimed identity in the course of somebody navigating or going about their business. It certainly would make sense for a community or group of communities of service providers to go through the whole defining a standards process, both for storage and retrieval and transfer of these biometrics across a number of systems, or at least defining how you might have something akin to OAuth support federated authentication of federated anonymous vouching for the ability or the entitlements of an individual based on a strong positive with a voice. There are communities talking about this, but it's very early days by our estimation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you...
Yeah, we've toyed with it a little bit. I mean, I think maybe with a question for everybody out here with a show of hands, how many of you would be willing to opt in your voice into this federated identity? Essentially, you can online enroll one time and use it around the internet. How many people would actually do it? So that's about half of you. I mean, that's pretty good. I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges I think people have had is allowing themselves to be opted in, of course, because of the Big Brother thing or just being scared in general about what would happen to my voice. So that's one of the big challenges. And, again, if getting that voice out there saying, hey, it's not your voice that's going to be compromised, if we can get a lot of people to opt into that method, it's something that could be very successful. Especially since, I don't know about you guys, but I really hate CAPTCHAs. I can never pass them anymore. So
I can't read those things.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Fourth try. Sin. But the other thing to consider is that it's a couple of government initiatives, and this is in the Middle East and in the United Arab Emirates. Australia actually talked about it initially, but as part of a program to reduce what amounts to welfare fraud, the idea that the government might be making payments to the big case is making payments to dead people. And there's a couple of initiatives being launched around something called a proof of life, because you have in your voice both the behavioral and the physical characteristics, and you can build an app that is basically somebody saying, hey, it's me, I'm alive, therefore I'm entitled to get my payments. And then when you think about getting financial incentive to register your voice, if the government makes it a precondition that you provide a biometric, and the government's starting to realize that voice is probably the easiest one to capture remotely, and that it does raise issues about establishing ground truth, establishing strong binding between your known identity and your voice, because if the fraud happens at time of enrollment, that's about the worst thing that can happen in this situation. But there are initiatives going along that line, and once you have, and this really is Big Brother, I suppose, the government having the voice print that can be shared across a number of applications, you have some precedent for what you're talking about.
Do we have any other questions?
Okay.
So y'all are talking a lot about like the secure aspects and keeping people from not accessing your accounts and this and that. What do you do in the event that you need someone to access an account? For example, like a parent with a child bank account or like a spouse. How do you work around them obviously not matching the voice that is with that account?
So there's two aspects to that that are interesting to talk about. One you can ground in the Bell Canada story, which the reason Bell Canada has the 3.5 million enrollees, and or probably closer to 5, I mean, at this point, and was one of the first to implement, is that they had that exact problem that you were talking about. It, at a time when, and most people have their own wireless phones now, but when they started out, it was an issue of a phone number for a home phone was a single number that was actually associated with 4 or 5, or, you know, depending on the size of the family, as many individuals as lived in that household. And that those different individuals had different entitlements when it came to, you know, what shows they could view on their cable, or just sort of go down the list, or that a kid might not want mom or dad to see their call records and who they've been calling and that sort of thing. So there was privacy around that, and they decided early on that it was important to come up with an identifier that was about the individual, not the phone number, in order to support essentially an individual's privacy, and that was a differentiator. So that's a role that using a biometric can play. The other side of what you're asking about, you know, we pay a lot of attention to false acceptance. And if you look at secure, when you talk to like the chief security officer to sell your solution, he'll tell you, well, you know, a single person getting through out of 100, that's a big loss on our part. But if you think of like an individual that you know, in a crisis situation is having trouble convincing a system to let them gain access to something that they need in an emergency, the notion of the importance of preventing false rejection is just as strong. And I would argue in the long term, as people gain experience, is even more important. You know, it's sort of like, I can't use my credit card to get gas. I'm in the middle of nowhere, and no matter what I do, I can't. It's like blocked, and I have to make a phone call to tell. So it all has to do with how you tailor it to implement it and take the individual into account. You know, not just the device, not just the security infrastructure. It gets very, very personal.
Yeah, and I would add that, I mean, a lot of times with these technologies is the 80-20 rule. You know, you want to solve for over 80% of your normal transactions. So essentially, as long as it's a convenience factor and the cost savings, if you can really get most of your population solved through the use of the technology, it's great. It's going to reduce their costs, and it's going to be more effective. But every now and then, you are going to have cases that are going to have to go to the de facto, maybe go back to the call center and have an override, especially in a parent-child case. You know, the child can't get in because over time, maybe their voice has changed. So it is one of those things that you're going to have a offset process flow that says, okay, you failed, you're not allowed to get in, let me ask you some of these out-of-wallet questions or something of that nature. So there's definitely going to be opportunities to do something different outside of that, because it's not going to be 100%, but it's the same thing with any technology. I mean, what the whole purpose of the technology is to try to deploy it and get a mass adoption and resolve a solution for you. Any other questions? You don't have to run, don't worry.
How are these companies like Bell Canada handling the enrollment of their customers into these voice recognition programs? How are these companies like Bell Canada handling the enrollment of their customers in these voice recognition programs? Are customers told what's happening and explained clearly? Is it opt-in, or are they given the opportunity to opt out?
So there isn't a single answer to that. There are some best practices emerging that have to do with getting the word out early and encouraging individuals to opt in and explaining why it's to their advantage to do that. And there's training of, initially training of your best contact center reps to march people through the process and do the level setting, but then retweaking the IVR. And this will sound less like an opt-in than you might imagine, but it turns out that the best thing is almost a customer rep supported opt-out methodology. So when somebody will call, they'll get sort of a preamble that says, you know, I see you haven't enrolled in our system. We'd like you to take 8 minutes or whatever to do it. You know, let's say 5 minutes or something that's acceptable. And the person can just say no, but if they don't, then they're automatically taken through it. So it is an opt-out situation at that point. And you know, they're getting, you know, I think when they started launching it in Bell Canada, they were thinking they might get like 25% people actually going ahead and enrolling, and it turned out to be more like 70 or 80%, and that was a pleasant surprise. The Turkcell didn't really give them the option. They just basically said, to get better service in the future, you know, please tell them we'd like to enroll you, and they kind of made it hard to opt out. So,
yeah, and I think there's two solutions to that, or I guess two scenarios. One is, do you already capture their voice? You know, if you capture their voice in some fashion, then essentially have access to verify them. They technically don't have to opt in at that point. However, you know, working with a lot of the legal teams, et cetera, you want to get some liability on your side in your favor that says, I'm not just taking advantage of someone's voice. You know, there's not really legislation out there that's capturing that yet, but knowing the government, there probably will be. So, you know, you want to get ahead of that as possible, you know, and really just have the due diligence to say, I've opted in, it's in my terms and conditions, things of that nature, just so you're not putting yourself at risk as a business.
Hi there. I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase, I guess, or classification of technology as dual-use technology.
It's
dual-use?
Dual-use.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Have you heard of this, let's say, classification? So, for example, encryption is classed as dual-use technology. It can be used for, in inverted commas, good uses and also for bad uses. So governments can encrypt and secure communications using encryption, but also terrorists and drug dealers and so on. Legal interception equipment in communications networks can be seen as dual-use for legal uses, but also illegal uses. Is voice biometric technology, how is that classed? Sorry, one more thing. Dual-use technology, there are certain restrictions, export restrictions to countries on certain types of, you know, that have certain human rights records, et cetera, where that technology is not allowed to be sold to those because for the good and bad reasons. What do you think of the possibility of using voice biometric in these certain situations?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess it boils down to, I mean, what would bad people do with this technology, or could they have access to this? So essentially, I mean, technically, you know, our salespeople, some people are in here, they do try to sell to anybody, so there's a chance of them selling a voice to some people out there, but we do want to make sure that we validate the individuals or the businesses that are using and their use cases for them. Mm-hmm. It's technically possible. I mean, if a gang that wants to use voice biometrics to send transmissions across, it's something they could use. You know, our business probably would not sign something like that unless it just came in through a business that looked legit and somehow got resold or reused. You know, there's definitely ways to get around that.
So it's more like in the case of, let's say, Syria or Libya, where it is very possible that voice biometric and voice prints could be used to identify people.
Yeah.
And it has been used in certain cases I don't know exactly the background of which type of technology, but this has happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, is there any legal restrictions on voice biometric technology?
There's none that I know of, and I'll look into that. But we're mostly talking about voice biometrics for authentication.
And
there's a whole body of use of voice biometrics for speaker identification.
Okay.
And there are there's just a lot of government use. I mean, the largest big dollar transactions that involve voice biometrics are taking legal wiretaps and just culling through them looking for bad guys.
Yep.
So, but I haven't heard the obverse of that. I haven't heard how the bad guys would use the voice biometrics, except to maybe identify when a law enforcement person is to find a rat or something like that. But there's some amazing stories about a couple of things. One is with language independent speaker identification, they have there have been a couple of cases that were accepted by courts in Germany where they busted drug lords who were speaking. We're speaking one language in one conversation and turned around and we're speaking German in the other, and they said that's the same person, and it stood up as evidence in court. And I know this isn't what you're asking
but there's
like a whole lot of dark science around the use of voice biometrics, primarily by by law enforcement. I was going to say the good guys, but it depends on your point of view. And so some of the largest sales of these technologies have been to the Mexican government for identifying drug lords. It's been also the international police, Interpol. There's a lot going on there. And it is something that we monitor. Well, we're monitoring what's going on in that because there are potential commercial uses of things that are used over in dark ops that eventually make it into commercial use around strong confident authentication of people anonymously and also once you've established that voice biometrics can be used in court irrefutably, there's a positive use for that around voice signatures and using it in contracts and that sort of thing. So I know that doesn't answer your question, but I'm always looking for the legitimate
yeah. Thank you.
Okay, appreciate thanks. It. So I think we're pretty much out of time. We want to thank everybody for showing up today and not going to Al Gore. Thank you.
Thank you.